Investors Chronicle.
Welcome to the Companies and Markets Show. It's Thursday, the 1st of February, as we record. January is finally behind us, and the new month is an auspicious one because it marks the publication of our biggest supplement of the year. It's the FTSE 350 issue, 40 pages running the rule over the companies in the FTSE 100 and the 250. Today, we're going to weave some of that discussion into our usual results analysis, starting with GSK's full-year figures and moving on to a brief chat about other FTSE Pharma players. Then we will turn to the US. January was another runaway month for some AI-focused stocks, notwithstanding the cooling effect of Jerome Powell's words last night. But there was less positive news from Alphabet and some mixed updates elsewhere. We will discuss the latest news from the Magnificent Seven later in the show. We'll also look at a couple of UK food and drinks players who've delivered the goods this month. That's Premier Foods and AG Barr. And to wrap up, we'll have a quick look at companies that are benefiting from the rise of regulation and compliance and fun things like that. Joining me to discuss all of this are Mark Robinson.
Hi, Dan. Good to be back.
Good to have you, Mark. Alex Newman.
Hi, Dan.
Jennifer Johnson.
Hi, Dan.
And over the line, Arthur Sants.
Hey, Dan.
Hi, Arthur. And we'll begin with GSK because they had the full year results out yesterday. For years now, there's been a lot of concern about its pipeline and more recently about litigation in relation to the Zantac heartburn drug. We'll get to that, but the results themselves, Jen, look healthy enough.
Yeah, so the results were really pretty positive and they definitely show that GSK is moving in the right direction in terms of growing both its earnings and its drug pipeline. The vaccines division was the real standout. Revenue is up 25%. That's largely thanks to Arexvy, which is its new vaccine against the RSV respiratory virus. The jab is currently only available in the US and only for people over the age of 60, yet it's still managed to record over $1 billion in sales since it launched in the third quarter of 2023. So it's going to roll out to other jurisdictions shortly, likely to be approved for use in younger people. So you can see that the kind of growth potential there is really quite significant. The other thing to highlight is the group shingles vaccine, Shingrix, which made $3.4 billion in 2023, which was a 17% improvement on the prior year. Its HIV franchise is another big revenue contributor. Sales there were up 13%, $6.4 billion. So in short, this is looking like an increasingly well-diversified company with some genuine growth prospects. And that wasn't necessarily the case 5 years ago.
And it also took the opportunity to set some long-term, in some cases, very long-term growth targets as well. What were they?
I guess the first thing to know is it's kind of one of the quirks of the pharmaceutical industry that companies are able to predict what sales might look like in 5 or 10 years with a reasonable degree of certainty. This is especially true for GSK, given it has a number of treatments for chronic illnesses like HIV. Demand for HIV drugs is pretty fixed and predictable. There's good data on how many people contract the virus every year and patients stay on medications for life. There's also good data on how many people are hospitalised with something like RSV every year and how many people are at risk for severe disease. So pharma companies also know, along with all of this kind of information about diseases, when the patents for key drugs are due to expire, meaning that revenue will fall drastically as generic competitors enter the market. So in 2021, GSK issued both a 5-year and a 10-year outlook, which is something that obviously not a lot of companies in other sectors can do. And it upgraded both of those in its 2023 results, which were released this week. By 2031, GSK now expects to achieve sales of more than $38 billion. This is an increase of $5 billion compared to the target that it set in 2021. So it's clearly a company that is feeling confident and feeling bullish for the first time in a while.
The downside, and this is something we've spoken about before, because it has lingered over the shares, as I said, for a little while, is the Zantac litigation, the legal cases relating to the allegation that this heartburn drug from the 90s caused cancer in some cases. We've been quite positive on GSK for a while. When you look at the share price in response to ostensibly good figures and pretty bullish long-term targets, it does seem like, doesn't it, that you can see some of this concern in there. Yesterday, there wasn't really a move on these numbers until the middle of the day. It was up a couple of percent. It's up another couple of percent now today on some small Zantac news. And there is, so it does seem that that concern about how much they'd have to pay in this litigation is holding them back a bit. However, some are hopeful for a resolution in the first half of this year.
Yeah, and it is fair to say that the share price reactions to recent results have seemed out of step with the reality of the numbers. And there are actually two things conceivably holding GSK back at the moment. The lesser factor, I think, is that one of its key HIV drugs is due to go off patent worldwide by the end of the decade. Given, though, that there's significant momentum elsewhere in the portfolio, this probably isn't going to be a huge drag on earnings or profits. The company actually said it expects operating margins to be broadly stable around the time period that the drug is going off patent. So investors shouldn't be overly worried there. The key issue, as you said, Dan, really seems to be this ongoing litigation around Zantac in the US. There were something like 80,000 lawsuits filed in total alleging that patients who use the drug developed various forms of cancer. Some of these lawsuits have now been dismissed at the federal level, and there have been some settlements made with plaintiffs in California, with the latest one being announced today. That means most of the remaining cases are now in the state of Delaware, where a judge is due to decide fairly imminently whether the evidence linking Zantac to cancer is admissible. If it is, some or all of the cases could proceed to trial, which is the outcome GSK is most keen to avoid. It definitely seems that the company is much more eager to settle with plaintiffs than it is to try and take them on in courts, because obviously there are reputational things on the line when you go to trial. It's very costly. And various analysts have sort of issued predictions for what they think the kind of ultimate liability for GSK is going to be. And it's a little bit of a take it with a grain of salt at the moment, given that there's still some uncertainty around it all. But for what it's worth, Jefferies said they envisage GSK reaching a global settlement in the first half of this year for its share of liability, because there are other companies who made drugs that are chemically identical to Zantac. And the liability estimate is between $2 billion and $3.5 billion. So it's significant, but conceivably, if that were to be announced, shares could still rise, because at least then you've got this tremendous uncertainty is kind of resolved. And I think it's not, shareholders and investors aren't helped by the fact that these cases can become very complicated. You will have some that are being heard by federal judges. You'll have some that are being heard by state judges. Each state looks upon these particular kind of lawsuits and the scientific evidence surrounding them a little bit differently. So it's not, it's not a black and white or kind of easy thing for shareholders to digest. But I would say things have moved clearly in a positive direction, and there's not a lot of reason to believe that GSK is going to get dragged through the courts and that shareholders really have a lot to fear, but it is something to keep an eye on.
Alex, what are your views on GSK?
Well, I suppose it was an interesting situation, because they maybe one of the legacies of the pandemic was that, despite, I suppose, they've got a really big reputation in vaccines, and obviously the Shingrix vaccine has gone great guns, but GSK missed out on the blockbuster potential for launching a vaccine when everyone needed one, at least ahead of its rivals. So maybe there was a bit of a depression in the sentiment towards the company then. And then I suppose since then, maybe the narrative has moved on, but we've had the Zantac overhang. So underneath all of that, you still have a kind of a science powerhouse here trading at, as Jen mentioned, about sort of 10 times earnings. And what is clear from, this week's announcement is that management are bullish about the long-term prospects, even if, the changes to guidance, a percentage point of adjusted operating margin here and 2 percentage points of average sales growth here, feel really kind of at the margins. You know, they're sounding confident. And I suppose the better news, arguably, for lots of GSK shareholders is that dividend, which came in quite a way ahead of consensus at 16p, the quarterly dividend, that is very well covered despite all these, you know, these other claims on cash. So, it seems like now the narrative with GSK is there's a strong long-term defensive investment case trapped under the latest sort of bout of pessimism. But yes, you know, signs are maybe sort of ticking in the right direction. I don't know if we can, you know, come on to this. The comparison always there with AstraZeneca maybe looks a little bit more favourable.
Mm. Well, I was going to come on to AstraZeneca. The dividend's a good point as well, as you say, you know, there's still a decent payout there as well. But Jen, is there the potential, turning here to our FTSE 350 section where we look at the entire pharma sector, in recent years, it's been very much a case of AstraZeneca being the UK powerhouse, GSK being the laggard, at least share price-wise. Is there potential for that to reverse? There are some signs that things are a bit trickier for AstraZeneca now as well. And also, just to cover off another FTSE pharmaceutical company, Indivior, which has had its own legal issues, to say the least, but they too may be solved now. So can we say a bit about both of those companies?
Yeah, so with AstraZeneca, I think it might be a bit drastic to say that its fortunes are going to reverse. Mm. But it is, again, this kind of links back to something that's happening in the US. There have been some jitters recently around AstraZeneca's exposure to the drug price controls that are part of the Inflation Reduction Act. Some of their cancer drugs, some of their kind of blockbuster drugs are likely to be affected. The degree to which they'll be affected kind of remains to be seen. But I think the key thing really to keep in mind with any of these fears around the Inflation Reduction Act is that there is a US election coming up, which could see, the legislative landscape change quite significantly, I guess is the diplomatic way to put it. So, yeah, it's a case of watch this space. AstraZeneca is still, you know, one of the biggest London listed companies. It still has an incredible portfolio, especially of oncology drugs. And, you know, demand for those sorts of things really isn't going to go anywhere. I don't think it's necessarily a case that sort of AstraZeneca has to fall from grace for GSK to ascend, though that does make kind of a neat narrative.
That's just all I was looking for.
Yeah, that's but yeah, I mean, it's conceivable that AstraZeneca could kind of enter a little bit of a period of stagnation, but there are a lot of factors really in play there. I guess to turn to Indivior now, which is a company in a very different situation to both GSK and AstraZeneca, which have these reasonably diversified drug portfolios. Indivior is more or less completely a manufacturer of treatments for opioid addiction. Those treatments are, again, vastly sold in the US. There really aren't significant other regions that contribute to earnings for Indivior. It had its own legal battle that lasted several years. It was an antitrust case involving one of its opioid addiction treatments, Suboxone. It was alleged that the company had switched to an oral film version of Suboxone from a tablet to extend its monopoly, just as there were going to be generic competitors that could enter the market to sell these lower-cost pills. The uncertainties around the litigation might have been solved for Indivior, but the key thing to keep in mind is that it's a company that is not particularly well diversified. Indivior, basically, it needs to, in the longer term, to kind of reassure shareholders, it needs to diversify away from these opioid addiction treatments. It's done fairly well with them, obviously, because of the scale of the epidemic, which has no real signs of abating. So while Indivior might be free of its legal woes, its pipeline woes are definitely something to keep an eye on, far more so than a company like GSK.
Yeah, I think as you mentioned earlier off air, it has been in the past trying to bring a schizophrenia drug through, which could help diversify. But for now, it is really reliant on that opioid focus. It was also featured in our Fallen Angels news piece we did this week, looking at companies who have slipped from mid-cap to small-cap status because it has struggled. some of the attraction ostensibly might be because you look at the sales of Sublocade and they're still soaring. You know, I think it's 55% in Q3 was the last figure. But that in itself is down a little bit on Q2. So there is some uncertainty over that rollout and, you know, whether they can maintain that given it is their one string to their bow currently. So, yeah, as you say, something to be aware of there. Let's turn to the US itself now, though, and some of the companies listed over there, because while we are now in February, January was another gangbuster month, certainly for the likes of NVIDIA. We have had a few earnings reports in the last few days, though, of course, and they've been a bit more mixed, thinking of Alphabet in particular. But Arthur, we'll come to you. You know, the performance at the start of this year certainly has been as it was last year, really. It's been very much about AI, maybe a bit more about the semiconductor cycle changing as well, and has been pretty good news on the whole for the Magnificent Seven, or certainly the AI-focused cohort there.
Yeah, it has. I think it's probably been a little bit of a case of what was driving the company's valuations last year as well, which is a combination of the interest rate environment. So inflation going under control and rate expectations falling, coupled with some hype around AI and the subsequent demand for all of the semiconductors that all these cloud computing companies are buying up. But as you said, yeah, we've had some, so I think we had some semiconductor results in the previous weeks, some of the international ones like ASML, which is the makes the photolithography machines, and TSMC, which is the big Taiwanese manufacturer. And then in the last couple of days, we've had sort of the big US software companies, so Microsoft and Alphabet, and then today we have Amazon and Meta. So it's sort of a case of, we know that people are buying loads of hardware. Investors are now curious to see whether the software side, so is actually going to start generating some earnings for these companies, because at some point the AI needs to be adopted by enterprises and then hopefully eventually, well, from in their perspective, consumers. So the market's now looking to see whether there's any like sort of real earnings being generated rather than just looking at the giant CapEx figures, which was kind of the story of last year, which was these companies trying to position themselves for this AI cycle.
Mm. Nonetheless, I am going to turn straight to those giant CapEx figures, because in Microsoft results, maybe Alphabet to an extent as well, but there was some sign that, you know, the sheer amount they are investing could be starting to, or could in future, weigh on earnings a little bit more. How did you read both the Microsoft and the Alphabet results, the latter obviously more affected by an advertising slowdown as well?
Yeah, on the CapEx point, it feels that the narrative might be changing slightly. I think last year, the big CapEx numbers were generally viewed as a good thing because people were aware that for the companies to be leaders in AI, they needed to have loads and loads of graphics processing units, which are the chips that NVIDIA makes, which is why NVIDIA's earnings have gone up so much. And there was sort of an arms race sense where they were buying as many as they could get their hands on and doing it as quickly as possible. And investors sort of would look at that CapEx figure, and if the CapEx figure was big, they'd see it as a sort of precursor to that company being a leader. So Microsoft, Google, Meta, Amazon have all been spending billions and billions on it. This was the first set of results, and I was reading through the analyst notes before this call, and then Alphabet's share price was down 6 or 7% on the day, and the analysts were trying to offer up reasons for it, even though they beat expectations on revenue and profit. And one of the reasons was, their CapEx figure was bigger than expected. It was up 50%-ish year on year. Same with Microsoft, and their cash flow. Alphabet's cash flow was down a lot, partly because they had this big tax bill, but even without a tax bill, it would have been down because of the CapEx investment from the same period last year, despite its profits being up. Alphabet's operating profit was up 27%. Yeah, its cash flow dropped because of the big CapEx expenditure. So now there's this sort of concern, actually, are they spending way too much on CapEx? Are they going to get the returns we expect? And is this AI thing just going to be insanely expensive for all of these companies to adopt? So that feels to, and then the other thing about Alphabet was that they then said the analysts were then concerned about the advertising revenue figures being below expectations. But the fact that it beat revenue expectations, even though advertising was weaker than expected, just means that cloud was stronger than expected. And people were saying, oh, we really want to see cloud revenue do well, because that's an indication of, that's like the growth business, and that's the indication of AI. So I don't know. It feels like, I guess with Alphabet in particular, there's a fear that the AI thing is going to be really, really expensive. And actually what made Alphabet a really great business was that it had an advertising monopoly, and maybe investors are getting a little bit more cold feet about the cost that's going to be associated with the whole AI process.
I suppose these are the consequences sometimes of being priced for perfection, or at least the perception that that is the case, because in some cases, you know, there are still valuation cases to be made. We did include NVIDIA in our ideas of the year again this year, having tipped it right at the end of 2022. So can we say a bit about, maybe Alex, I'll turn to you for your sort of thoughts on the opening of 2024 for the Magnificent Seven, or for the big AI, the big tech stocks in particular. I keep qualifying that because Tesla has had quite a bad start to the year, but obviously it is quite different from, you know, the tech giants themselves. How do you view the whole thing?
Yeah, well, I think on that point, we're certainly seeing a bit of bifurcation within this Magnificent Seven grouping. And inevitably, it's the latest acronym that we've seen countless iterations over the last decade. And this may be the time to retire it, because, you know, Tesla down 25%. You're not allowed to do that, really, as a magnificent stock, are you, in the course of a month?
Well, I did see someone make the good point recently that in the film The Magnificent Seven, and indeed the Seven Samurai in which it was based, I think three or four ended up dead. Okay. So maybe the analogy could carry on. Anyway, sorry.
No, that perfectly writes features for the end of the year, I suppose. Yeah. So, I mean, even within the grouping, you've got, as Arthur really clearly outlined there, you've got the way some hardware providers, well, let's look at NVIDIA especially, have really run away with things, because they are selling to the rest of the grouping. Stocks like Apple, I mean, Apple's basically a wash so far this year, and they were up a mere 48% last year, which, you know, doubled the S&P 500. But within the grouping, that was the smallest gain, partly because it was from a lower base, 2022 being a brutal year for a lot of these tech stocks, but also it's just reflecting the defensive qualities and kind of slower growth prospects of a, you know, $3 trillion company. I suppose the biggest takeaway I've had from the last week of earnings and trying to parse what some of these, you know, the latest goings on means for this group, and, you know, I should add the caveat that, you know, quarterly earnings, there's a lot of drama and fuss made over them, but it's really the long term which obviously counts, is I suppose with Microsoft. So they, if we take, you know, sort of step back and look at what's projected here, cloud is really going to be the growth engine for them, is what people are assuming. So they made $38 billion here last year. That's expected to climb to $86 billion over 4 years, an average compound annual growth rate of 23%. Sorry, that's operating profit. I mean, everyone by now is very familiar with the story, so there's lots of sensitivity to any sort of micro shift in growth expectations. By contrast, I think maybe I'm just kind of reiterating a little bit the point that Arthur was making here. Google doesn't really seem primed to catch up in the same way, because it's operating from a much lower base when it comes to the cloud, so it's having to invest more. And maybe Google is now more a play on consumer internet growth as a story, and, you know, that's always going to grow in the decade ahead, but it's not going to grow at the same clip as the technology infrastructure providers, owners like Microsoft and their hardware suppliers. So, yeah, I mean, Microsoft, it has been looking a little ahead of its recent trading multiple, 30 times earnings. That, yeah, you talked about perfect pricing, probably, but it has continually justified that. And it still seems, of the pack, the one with the clearest growth story. Obviously, NVIDIA is just tearing away at the moment, but how sustainable those earnings are, you might question in sort of 2025, 2026 onwards. So, yeah, I mean, so much to unpack, but Microsoft still seems pretty strong.
Arthur, just to wrap up on this section, as you said, we do have Amazon and Meta and Apple reporting later today. By the time this podcast goes out, everyone will know those figures. But what's your sense of how they might fare or how they're faring currently, regardless of quarterly earnings?
Well, they're also slightly, as kind of Alex is pointing again, words that we bunch them together.
Yeah.
They're all very different kinds of companies
that is
with
true.
Some sectors of overlap. So Amazon's like a split story where obviously it's got the cloud computing bit of the story. Amazon's the market leader. It's by far the biggest and was the first to get into cloud computing, but is now growing the slowest. Azure, which was Microsoft's cloud, accelerated to 30% annual growth from last quarter, thanks to six percentage points of growth from AI, up from 3 percentage points of growth from AI last quarter. So they're getting quite a good AI tailwind for their cloud computing business. Whereas, and then Google's growing at, was it 26% annually, which is down from 37% annually this same quarter last year. And Amazon was down in the low teens, although growing from a much larger base. So I think people will be hoping and are expecting Amazon's cloud computing growth to start accelerating back up again, similar to what's happened at Microsoft. And then on the other side, they invested loads in their logistics business, and UPS and FedEx just had some pretty bad results. In part, people think because they're losing a lot of business to Amazon. And there's a hope, I guess, from Amazon investors that Amazon's going to start showing that it's become very profitable in, it's growing more profitable in its logistics business and third-party logistics. So doing shipping for other people. So that's like, when you're comparing these stocks, it's like, oh yeah, well, Amazon's also a ginormous logistics business, which is like nothing, which is completely different to all of the other Magnificent Seven. And then Meta is kind of similar to Google. They just both make almost all of their money from advertising. And then Mark Zuckerberg goes off and says that he's also trying to build artificial general intelligence, but that's not going to be making him any money yet. That's just going to come up in ginormous CapEx figures, like the same with Google and Microsoft, and then they'll have lost loads of money with their headsets again. So that's what we can look forward to. But in general, I think I was being a bit negative, but the results were generally pretty good. Like, these companies are growing double digits. Microsoft's almost top line growth at 20%, and it's a $3 trillion company, and it's forecasting operating margins to expand 1 or 2 percentage points this year, despite all of this investment. So it may be, and as Alex said, the earnings results can be a lot of drama. And my takeaway is I'm a little bit shocked at how much share prices can move based on pretty short-term information, particularly with Google. So, and generally, they continue to perform pretty well. Maybe it was just because the share prices, as you said, had run up so much in the last year that people wanted to take profits, and anything that was looked weak at all was an opportunity to sell. But things will probably keep going in the way they've been going for the last 2 decades with these monopolies for a little bit.
I tend to think at some point in the future as well, when you look at the commercial relationship between Microsoft, Alphabet, and indeed IBM to a certain extent, it's going to feed into that age-old debate about first mover advantage as well. But this will only become clear over time.
Mm. Well, Mark, you have been sitting patiently until now, waiting for your time. And that time has come, because we're going to talk about AG Barr and a little bit on Premier Foods now. AG Barr figures seemed, again, like the recurring theme today, pretty good.
Yeah, definitely. The management did point out that there were some barriers emerged during the latter part of the summer. It wasn't terribly good in terms of weather conditions for sales, apparently, although what difference the weather makes when you're drinking iron brew is lost on me. But
yes, we should say AG Barr, for those who don't know, the iron brew and general soft drink manufacturer.
Well, yes, and beyond its sort of flagship beverage as well, it's the influence of M&A over the last year or so, which has provided a real boost for the company itself. It took on three new subsidiaries at the end of 2022. And of those, perhaps the most impressive results have come from Mama Foods, which is a producer of oat-based alternatives to dairy products, the type of things that you find increasingly in coffee shops as well. And sales there are up or remain in double-digit levels at the moment, which has been really good for the company. But even when you take away the influence of that M&A, organic sales are up by 7.6% during the period. Profits are looking a little bit better as well, not least because while cost pressures are still in evidence, they've subsided quite a bit from the prior year figures too. So on the broker research that I looked at this morning, they said that it's improved chances for near to medium term profit upgrades. So it was a generally favourable result. The company separately announced that Ewan Sutherland, an ex-Saga boss, has been promoted as chief executive, and he starts at the beginning of May there. And he's coming in at a decent time for the company as well. More of the manufacturing has been brought in-house. It's a more diversified range now. And it's slightly ironic in the fact that they have brought in Mama Foods as well, because, I mean, AG Barr was never synonymous with the health food side of that market. But it's been, you know, a positive outcome, I think.
It's an interesting shift for the chief executive going from Saga to Iron Brew.
Yes, yeah.
Perhaps that will show the transferability of some of their skills. The shares have had some decent momentum in recent weeks as well. How do you see the sort of the valuation, the prospects there?
I had a look at that, and I think the forward rating was 17 times consensus earnings, which is, you know, it doesn't scream value, but you look at it from a historical perspective, and it's not a bad entry point at the moment. That sort of surprised me a little bit, but particularly given those medium-term upgrades of the chances of those have increased. So I think, you know, it's not an unreasonable entry point at the present time.
Well, AG Barr is part of our FTSE 350 review, as you'd expect, and as is another company, Premier Foods, which has also done very well recently and over the last 3-6 months really as well. It too had a trading update out recently and raised guidance a few months ago. Things looking pretty strong there. This is the Mr. Kipling maker. Alex, I'll turn back to you maybe for some thoughts on Premier Foods, because it's turned up in a couple of momentum screens as well recently.
It has, yeah. I suppose the momentum here a little bit stronger than AG Barr, but that's likely a function of Premier Foods' balance sheet, which is, I mean, AG Barr pretty negligible debt, whereas Premier, you know, they've got a bit of debt on the balance sheet. So, you know, the pivot in interest rate policy backdrop we've seen over the the last 4 months has been probably more beneficial to them. But, you know, focusing on the on what they do, I mean, they're just a very, very solid company, and they, you know, went through a fair bit of turmoil like every other food manufacturer in the last couple of years of how you're balancing price with cost inflation. That has settled a little bit now, but their brands that they have and the markets they're in, remain pretty solid. I mean, that, you know, it's not just Mr. Kipling. They sort of distribute Cadbury's cakes. They're in, you know, OXO, Bisto, Paxo. So they had a very good Christmas there. Apparently it's their best ever. You know, just very solid brands, reliable sales. But, you know, they've got options to pivot into new markets and product lines, I suppose, a little bit how, you know, in the way that AG Barr has done successfully with their M&A. They're also looking, you know, abroad, and their growth in the US in particular has been pretty solid. So, you know, if you're able to crack that food market, then that's, you know, presumably happy days. I don't know if it's all of their products. I don't know if Angel Delight is making a big splash in the US, but I think Sharwood sources, they're saying. I think Mr. Kipling is also finding some aisle space. Mm. Dan, you're also a fan, aren't you, of Premier Foods? You highlighted them as the FTSE 350.
So, yeah, I did the the food producers for C350 section, and they were the pick. I mean, there are some. Immediately going to caveat my own confidence because they have made a couple of acquisitions in the past year or couple of years, which are their first for a decade and a half, really. I think there is that Spice Tailor brand, a breakfast brand called Fuel 10 UK, which sounds like a different kind of breakfast to the kind I eat, but it's quite popular, I imagine, those kind of things nowadays. So they will have to bed those in. That said, the expansion of those and the internationally seems to be going well so far. It's been able to take market share at the same time as balancing this volume price, conundrum, which, as you say, has been affecting most food producers in recent times, given the inflationary increases. I think it helps that it's fairly keenly priced still nonetheless. Inflationary costs, input costs are now falling as well. So, there's a margin opportunity there for those companies. I'm sure retailers and the likes of us would like to see some prices fall, but nonetheless, there's some opportunity there from the business side. I think also that when you consider general economic trends, those kind of foods are the kind that may benefit this year if people do eat in a bit more. It's one of those companies in that space which can benefit from at-home dining. So there are some positive strands to the business, certainly, and that expansion so far is going quite well. We should now turn, though, because time is running quite short. That was a very brief section on the food producers, but we're going to turn to regulation, Mark, because you've written another piece this week on companies taking advantage of regulation and compliance and the growth of these issues as something that businesses and all of us must pay attention to.
Yes, I regret to say that it's certainly a quite a dry piece as well, but I just thought
sold it really well to the listeners.
I know, yeah. I know. If you could spare a moment.
To hype it up a bit, you did pick out three companies that will be particular beneficiaries or are doing quite well.
Absolutely.
And one, we'll only talk about one of them maybe just to try and create some incentive to have a look at the piece.
Probably I didn't kick it off in the best manner possible, but I got the idea this originally when a couple of years ago the FCA effectively made Provident Financial change their business model, and the subsequent entry, Vanquis Banking, was forced to sell its personal finance arm as well. And so it just struck me as being sort of emblematic of what's been happening in the regulation compliance market in recent years. We've seen a real expansion in the number of regulatory bodies and plus the compliance standards that companies are being forced to follow. And this is partly due to the influence of supranational bodies like the EU, but also the OECD and the modern version of, or the reform version of NAFTA, which is the USMCA. But you combine that with the ever-tightening standards linked to ESG and corporate governance as well. And it creates a real minefield for companies. But by the same token, for specialists in the field, it provides opportunities too. And too often, I think companies, when you look at a report, and companies refer to compliance costs, that's seen in a negative. But there is a school of thought which says that it's actually an investment in the business as well, and it's hard to go beyond that view as well when you just look at the fact that there are so many international organisations that have are putting forth these measures now. I mean, it's most prominent, of course, within the financial services sector and the banking sector, and bodies like the Prudential Regulation Authority, they've got their work cut out for them now in relation to public markets. And we've seen a number of reforms post-Brexit too, which are providing opportunities. The companies that I picked out were Experience. Well, with the subheading there is cash through complexity, and obviously they're more synonymous with their credit checking, their core services there. But increasingly, the fastest growing part of their business is the B2B aspect, which enables companies to keep on top of their compliance obligations. I also looked at Halma, which is a more obvious example in many ways, because obviously the proliferation that we've seen in health and safety regulations and that certainly came to the fore because of the Grenfell Tower disaster as well. And the last company I look at as well is Intertek, and there's other points there like certification services that they deal in. And that is a reflection really of the impact of globalization and the need to regulate trading standards internationally. So I think it's an area which is appreciated by our readers and listeners, but I don't think that there's much chance of we're going to see a bonfire, which is a word the politicians like to use in relation to regulatory affairs. Although the upcoming US election, we may see changes there, because obviously Donald Trump is one for simplifying matters for business. But I think it's just a growth sector of the economy and one worth looking at.
Well, you have named all three companies there, so you know if people are interested in those, they can find out more in the piece.
They should be interested. It's dry, but in a purely academic sense.
And sometimes, you know, that's where the best investment opportunities come from. And as you point out with Experian, people may be overlooking that side of the business.
Yeah, I should really remember to sell the sizzle and not the steak.
Well, indeed. As I say, that is in the magazine this week and online. Covering those three companies, who are Experian, Intertek and Halma. Halma have a very interesting head office I recently discovered in Amersham.
Oh, really?
A lovely old brewery, or at least it's next to there. Oh. So, I don't know, maybe that's good for productivity of employees, because it's very nice. That's yes. All I can contribute on Halma, I'm afraid.
Well, I think the IC should consider a similar switch.
Well, yeah. Hope springs eternal. Anyway, on that note, we have reached the end of the show. Thank you very much to everyone for joining me. Thank you to Mark, to Alex, to Jen, to Arthur for getting up at 7 a.m. New York time and joining us, and to our producer, Maddie Apthorpe. And thank you to you for listening. We'll be back next time with another Companies and Markets show.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.